Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
This is Patricia Camilleri, welcoming you to University Matters on Campus FM. In this series, together, we shall continue to discover more about the work of the university's academics and about the many activities that will be taking place on campus over the next year. I'm delighted to have with me in the studio today on University Matters on Campus FM, Dr. Sheila Watson. Dr. Watson had got her first degree in history and archaeology. She followed this with a PhD in modern history. She's taught history in secondary schools and then moved to museum education. She trained as a museum professional and managed three museums and an art gallery in Great Yarmouth, Norfolk in England. In 2003, she became a lecturer in the School of Museum Studies at the University of Leicester, where she is now deputy head of school. Her research interests are museums and communities, contested histories, emotions, and the museum. Welcome to you, Dr. Watson.
Hello, Patricia. Thank you very much for inviting me to talk to you today.
Well, of course, this is a subject close to my heart, so I'm very much looking forward to this chat. Let's start off with a bit of a general question about museums. They've got an old history going back to the Renaissance. However, our Western image of the national or the municipal museum is rather particular. It has become, one could say, an ubiquitous icon. Why do you think that is?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I suspect there are lots of reasons for that, but let's look at one or two museums and see why that's happened. I think what's very interesting is that, in a sense, the museum arose out of the Enlightenment, when the idea came about that actually we could understand things in a way that's very different from before, where perhaps we were not understanding how the world worked. So museums became a place where we could classify and put objects in and then begin to understand the world. So, for example, natural history, particularly as ideas later on, things like Darwin came in, we could begin to put things in order and begin to understand them. At the same time, we also began to think that we could collect and display things that had an artistic bent, for example, such as sculptures and paintings. And again, we could understand civilization, we could understand great art, and also we could collect materials and begin to display history. But by doing that, we began to show who we were to other people. And in particular, nations began to collect things, and cities, towns, municipal areas did, and there became a rivalry. So what one country did, another country would want to do too. So museums became icons for various reasons. They became icons of identity. So that's very important. For example, in England, we know that once London had set up its national museums, places like Leeds, Sheffield, Manchester, Liverpool, in the Industrial Revolution, they wanted museums too. But they weren't really trying to rival the London one. What they were doing was showing their other neighbouring cities that they were better than them. So as soon as Manchester set up a municipal art gallery, then Liverpool did. And what Liverpool did, then Glasgow wanted to do. And this pattern is repeated across Europe. And so what we have now are large numbers of museums which are really not just about the knowledge, but are telling other places, this is who we are, this is our type of society, and we are part of, in Europe anyway, a traditional classical civilization. We are civilized, we understand this type of civilization, and we are able to collect, we are wealthy, and this is who we are.
This was a reflection of the image that they wanted to give to other people, really.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of museums are, quite often, traditionally, have been less about the environment in which they're situated, the citizens in whose town or city they are. They've been more about the other people visiting and showing off to those other people the citizens' culture, and it's been less about the visiting individual from that particular area, more about the visitors from outside. So in a sense, it's a bit of propaganda. It's a bit of this is who we are, and come and admire us and admire the fact that we understand civilization. And it was all very competitive, you know, who could collect the best of everything and show it to the world.
The Louvre and the British Museum, just to take two very iconic examples, they had slightly different origins, one born out of works which were collected from aristocrats during the revolution, and the British Museum born out of a private collection of somebody who then donated that to the nation. But the ethos was perhaps similar, glorification of the nation, as we were saying, also education of people out there. Has this been a heavy legacy to carry for museums since then? They've had to go on for years and years with this original idea on their back, so to speak.
Well, again, I think this is an interesting question, because I think museums actually change more than they appear to do. What's very interesting about the Louvre and the British Museum is that they were established in buildings that soon became very iconic buildings, and therefore, because the outer shell looks the same, there is a sense that maybe they have carried on these traditions forever. But if we look at the histories of those museums, actually we find that they change a great deal over time. So, for example, in the British Museum, yes, it was a collection. It was actually, interestingly enough, a collection given to London by an Irish doctor, which in fact, you know, this is very interesting in itself. And it was a mixture of collections, because the British Parliament then added in various things themselves. And right from the very beginning, this museum developed and changed. And what's very interesting about the history of both these museums is that over time, the curators had a great deal of influence, and they have developed different views of what they should be doing. So, for example, the British Museum started off, as you say, as very much a national museum, and it's morphed and changed over time into being what is now considered to be a museum of the world. Now, this is in part an attempt by the museum itself to say, look, we've taken things in the past from different civilizations, we don't want to give them back, but we're open free in London. But at the same time, I think it does show a genuine different way of looking at things, in the sense that knowledge is free and open to everybody, and there is a case for saying that some museums should show the world to itself. So the British Museum has massive collections. It's collected them over 2.5 centuries, nearly 3 centuries now. It shows a collection of things that have a power, and it shows that, you know, this is how the world could be. But the collections change, that the things that are out, displays change, the way in which things are displayed change. And similarly, the Louvre, it started off for saying this was the aristocratic private collection. It's now the collection of the people. The Louvre's gone on collecting. It's now become an international centre of excellence. So to go back to your question, has this been a heavy legacy? I don't know whether the museums think of it as a legacy as such. I think they tend to think they're changing a lot more than their outside physical appearance would suggest.
That's interesting, because one tends to look at this. I remember the classical sort of 19th century museum described as being similar to the bank next door, which is a significant comparison, possibly, because we're talking about power and money as well as aesthetics. You touched on this rather hot issue of the British Museum having collections from many countries and having very little intention of giving them back. This has become a point of discussion in the museum world, shall we say, with regard to anything from native Indian coats and or bones, perhaps, to the Elgin marbles. I mean, will we ever sort of get around this problem?
I think that it's an international problem. And the way I look at it is that while certain things like the Elgin marbles become, if you like, the hot topics, and they're always contested, actually we could contest virtually everything. So let's take, for example, the head of Nefertiti in Berlin, which is one of the most beautiful objects, iconic objects, of Egyptian civilization. And until recently, the Egyptians didn't show a great deal of interest in it, but now they're asking for it back. And the museum authorities in Berlin are saying, no, you can't have it back because we acquired it legitimately and we want to keep it. And I think it is a big philosophical question about what happens to objects which at the time were perhaps legitimately bought and sold and acquired or given as gifts and are now in another country. And then that the country of origin wants them back. Does that country of origin have a right to them? And the example I sometimes use is an iconic object like the Bayeux tapestry. Now, the Bayeux Tapestry, for those of you who are unfamiliar with it, but many of you will know about it, is a great piece of embroidery that shows the conquest of England by William the Conqueror. And it was commissioned by Odo, Bishop of Bayeux. That's why it's in Bayeux. It's in France now. But it was sewn by English seamstresses, and it shows the conquest of England. And it was originally created in England. Now, of all the iconic objects in the world that belong to England, I would say that Bayeux Tapestry belongs to England, because it is the story of the nation. And yet, it sits in France. And so if we're going to start this untangling of who owns what and who should have it, I think we need to set up a set of principles about what becomes an object, why does it become this object, what significance has it got now for people, has it changed over time, and do we have principles that say certain objects belong to nations because they have significance for the nation, or do we say each object brings with it a history and a patina of history, if it were. And actually, that object has changed its meaning over time, and it has meanings for many nations, because we could say that now the Bayeux Tapestry has a meaning for Bayeux. The very name suggests that it belongs to Bayeux. Should Bayeux be forced to give it up and give it back to England? Well, maybe it belongs as much to Bayeux as it does to England, which is, of course, the view that most English people would take. So I think it's a very complicated thing. I think it needs a lot of international getting together to decide who has what. And to be perfectly frank at the moment, I can't think that that's going to happen. So most museums go into the default mode of, we're not going to give anything back.
In the 70s, there was the new museology, yes, where things really started to change, and there was a lot of questioning about what museums were for, who was accessing them. You mentioned before the fact that the museums were created more for the visitor than for the indigenous population. But new museology tried to shift that emphasis. How did things change around that time?
Well, I suppose if we start off with the new museology, which was a very interesting idea, which was basically museums owe something to the communities in which they are located, and that they should be much more available to those communities and work with them. So there should be a more democratisation of the museum. That idea had a very long history, but it became very popular in the 1970s. So it wasn't new so much in the 1970s as it suddenly became the idea of the time. It's had an interesting history, that idea. Some museums have embraced it with enthusiasm. Other museums, it appears that they have never heard of it. So what we've got now in the museum world across the world, and not just in the UK, but in various countries, is we've got examples where museums have tried really hard to become more relevant to their local community. Doesn't necessarily mean to be the community of origin, but it's mainly the community in which it's located. And this has taken many forms. So, for example, museums developed a whole new set of programs. Outreach became very popular, particularly in the 80s and 90s and the early 21st century. Now there's a move to democratize the museum. Outreach is now seen sometimes to be a little bit patronizing, like, oh, that community in which the museum is situated, let's go out to the people and say, look, we've got all these lovely objects, would you like to come in, or can we take them to you? Now there is a move towards a sense that maybe the communities, the various communities in which museums are located, should be more about engaging with the people about how they themselves would like the objects to be displayed, what sort of museums they would like, how the museum can support them, both in education, but perhaps in identity making. And so things are gradually shifting. But as I said, it's a very, very slow process, and some museums have not yet changed at all.
Probably this is a good point to mention the museum which you created yourself and your team, the Time and Tide in Great Yarmouth, because that was a museum that was born from a lot of trying to achieve consensus about what was wanting to be recorded, what people wanted to record. Perhaps you could just briefly outline that experience. I know it was one that went on for many years.
Yes.
But
perhaps I ought to say what happened right at the beginning, which was that I became a museums officer in Great Yarmouth. I applied for the job, I got it, and I arrived, and I found that in the three very small museums that I was in charge of, and the art gallery, virtually nobody from the local area ever came to them. If anyone came, it was tourists. And the museums didn't seem to have any purpose for the local people. And to be frank, they were pretty much time warp museums. They hadn't had funding. And I suggested that we ask local people what, if anything, the museums could do for them and how they could see their history and heritage in them. And at the time, people were quite sceptical because the communities in which these museums were placed were very deprived. There were poor levels of education, the communities were very divided, there was a lot of alcoholism, a lot of drug abuse, quite a lot of transient groups. And there was a sense that, you know, you should leave sleeping dogs lie, and that actually the local communities didn't really want anything to do with this, and why didn't I just focus on the tourism? So I was very, very lucky to have, right at the beginning, somebody called Susie Fisher, who was a professional consultant who does lots of work for big companies, normally companies that sell things like chocolates and things like that. And her research expertise was in actually getting people to say what they wanted and how you should market brands, which seems a million miles away from museums. But she'd also done some work for the Science Museum in London, and she'd done a little bit of work for museums, trying to work out what audiences wanted. So she came to help us. And one of the first things she said to me, which changed the way I worked, was that, Sheila, you should stop thinking about what you've got and what you want to give to people, and actually sit down with a very open agenda and ask people, what does history, heritage, art mean to you? And what does it mean to you living in this place? And how can these disciplines, if you like, these things work for you? And she said, and otherwise you will still have empty, perhaps prestigious museums, but nobody will come to them because they won't mean anything to anyone. And it was a bit of a gamble, because I remember talking to people who were quite sympathetic with me, but they would say things like, well, people don't want museums, Sheila. They don't want history. They don't want heritage. They just want better double glazing. They want better lighting at night. They want those practical things. If you ask people, they'll just do that. They'll just say that. But actually, once we started off, we found that people were passionate about their sense of place. They were passionate about the place they lived in. They felt very let down. They didn't understand what the museums were for. They felt that a lot of history and heritage had been taken from them. They sort of wanted access to it. And much to my surprise, they just didn't want the vision we had, which was to redo the little museums we had. They wanted a whole new big museum.
And it must have been quite a shock to discover that.
It was a terrible shock. It was not what I wanted to hear. Not only did they want a new big museum, but they wanted to take part in how it was put together. And to go back to what I said originally, actually what was interesting was they wanted it not just for themselves, but they wanted to show the world that they weren't just this poor, deprived, despised community, but they had a great history of fishing, for example, that the place Yarmouth, which was seen to be rather run-down seaside town, actually had an ancient and proud set of traditions, etc., etc. So to cut a very long story short, over 7 years, I then worked with the community annually in a variety of consultative ways, which included focus groups, qualitative interviews, going to groups, talking about what we were doing, gradually building up a picture of the sort of museum they wanted. And I applied for 3 times for funding from Heritage Lottery Fund in England. Twice I was turned down because they didn't do two new museums, but finally on the third go, I think they gave up and said, all right, we'll give you the money. And I got money from other
places.
The system
pays off.
And so this is a museum that's now been developed in an old fish curing works, which tells the story of Yarmouth as the people in the town wanted it told, not the way we as curators wanted to tell it. So it was a very interesting and extraordinary experience to go through.
I've been to the museum, I've been to Time and Tide, and as soon as you walk in the door, you can smell the fish coming out of the walls. I mean, it's really a wonderful location, and very much where a place where there's a museum in a venue which is really appropriate to it.
Well, again, the community chose that place. I mean, very early on, they knew this fish factory. It was the last big fish factory in Yarmouth because the fishing itself had disappeared, and they carried on doing factory work with fish, importing it for a while, and it closed down in 1989. And so for the people, it was the last vestige of something they thought was really, really important to them. And you're right, the whole place stinks of fish. Well, parts of it stink of fish, not all of it. Mm. And that is very much part of what they wanted.
Not that it puts you off,
no,
it's all part of the feel.
It also had, it was interesting, interesting because, you know, when you do these big projects, you just don't realise what you're getting into. And so we had an architect and a designer, and we talked about, you know, keeping that ambiance. And then about the first weekend, a project manager came to me and she said, what do you want to know, the good news or the bad news? I said, the good news. She said, the good news is we'll keep the smell of the fish because we can't get rid of it. The bad news is that fish have been smoked there for like 200 years. Fish apparently have small amounts of arsenic in their oil. And now the whole building is full of arsenic.
Oh, my God.
Poisonous. So she said it's going to cost us a lot to treat the arsenic. But, of course, we did. We had contingencies and we treated the arsenic. But that's one of the things that you find out as you go along as part of the project. Because when you think about it, why would you ever make a museum in an old fish factory which smells of fish? So there were benefits, the authentic smell. There were disadvantages, the arsenic in the walls. But that was fine. We dealt with that. But then we had to get scientists in. We had to get special people in and give them the challenge. We don't want you to get rid of the smell. We don't want you to stop the walls looking like they've been, you know, dripping with fish oil for years. But actually, could you just make them not dangerous to touch?
Would be useful.
Yes. And they came up with something that they could spray on the wall, and it was fine.
There are certain things that you used in that museum which were quite innovative at the time, mm-hmm. things like video and personal remembrances as well. I think that really had come across and was very emotive.
Yes, well, we were trying to do what the people wanted. So they while we thought originally that they'd only want things within living memory, they wanted a lot of stuff from the past, and they wanted to show that Yarmouth had a big traditional history and archaeology. But you're right, when we were doing the emotional stuff, which was like in the First World War, we had a story of a man who said goodbye to his sweetheart, and then he went off to fight but came back and found that she'd been killed by a raid. We were basing that on real stories, and we wanted to show that actually, while this was a narrative story of a town, actually it was the story of the people, and it was the everyday individual stories of triumph and tragedy that were important. And again, that came out very strongly in the consultation exercises we did, which is people said, we don't want it romanticised, we want the gritty realism. That we, you know, it wasn't all fun. Going out on the fishing boats was absolutely ghastly job sometimes. Gutting the fish on the quayside was horrible sometimes. The women would have their hands bandaged, bleeding, trying to gut the fish in freezing conditions. But they said that, you know, we're proud of this very, very strong work ethic we had. We're proud of the fact that our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our ancestors, you know, worked really hard for a living, and they were proud people, and they had a culture that was theirs. And so we tried to bring in as many stories as we could of the ordinary, everyday lives of people, and not just this is an object, but, you know, who used it, what was it like, what were their stories.
I think that looking at the museums that there are in England or today, the ones with which I'm most familiar, you've got now a very varied list of types of museum. You have still got the municipal kind of museum, but you've got more hands-on, you've got community museums. How are museum studies and museum theorists like yourself, how are you coping with this very wide range of things that call themselves museums? But yeah. I wonder whether that name has stuck and somehow things have changed.
They have changed a great deal. And one of the ways we cope with it is we try and stop thinking about museums in a very traditional way. So we still teach what we call museum studies, but we think museum studies is a very broad umbrella. And I mean, as academics, we love names. We love calling things. So you'll find there's heritage studies in one corner, museum studies in another corner. But within our own field of museum studies, we like to think that we are a very broad church. We encompass what many people call heritage studies. And we have now broadened museum studies out so that it's not just about the physical building, but it's about the built environment, the intangible practices, the day-to-day living of people. So museum studies is about, if you like, the way the past is used today in a whole range of ways, not just in a museum, which is a fairly static, physical thing, but how people use the stories, the narratives, the buildings to make sense of who they are and how they, that is woven into their lives.
And also the other thing that has been new since the 70s is, of course, technology.
Yes.
And I think that must be creating a new approach, a new attitude towards people visiting or people finding out about other places.
Absolutely. I mean, digital technology, as we call it, is incredibly important. In fact, we have a distance learning course on digital technology, which is entirely run digitally. There's a surprise. because we recognise how important this is. And it has democratised things in a very different way. And I can give you one example of how that's happened, for example, in the V&A Museum. The V&A Museum, I used to talk to the head of communications in the V&A Museum, and she gave me an example of the way the museum itself has been moved through this digital technology to change the way it did. So, for example, one of the things that museums now try to do is put things online. So the V&A went through its archive and found it had a lot of old knitting patterns. So it started to scan them and put them free online. They'd passed out of copyright. And then people started emailing in with pictures of the clothes that they had knitted and showing themselves and their children wearing them. So then the museum set up a sort of blog site, like a knitter's club, and people began to exchange information about how to knit, what sort of the best wools there were. And so a whole community online developed, it's now very fashionable again in England to do knitting. And Gail Durbin, she's now retired, but she was then in charge of this digital technology, said this was an example of the way the museum had, in a sense, supported a community, many of whom would never go to the museum because they were actually quite international, but they were interacting with each other using these knitting patterns and swapping, and they themselves were then scanning old knitting patterns that the museum itself didn't have, scanning them, putting them online for other people to share. And she said that was an example of the way museums now have to be and can be much more responsive to the way the communities develop. And she said, if we tried to do that ourselves, we'd probably never have worked. But the point was, that was entirely spontaneous, but a few dedicated knitters doing that and sparking this enthusiasm of the traditional knitting.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up. Thank you very, very much, Dr. Sheila Watson, for coming to talk to us about museums. You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-programm li għadkom kemm smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.